that whatever it is that is understood as a norm of religiousness in Catholics have more of it, most of it, Protestants next and Jews least. Now there are significant exceptions, and we're at the point of one of the exceptions. This scheme of religious normativity holds for belief in God, church attendance, measured in three different ways, the conviction of the importance of religion, but it breaks it's still true about the conviction that the Bible is the real word of God, but there the difference are so slight since everybody can believe that. The national figure for those who believe that the Bible is the real word of God is 83%. Variation can be only small, and therefore not very significant. Now, a break takes place when we touch upon reading of the Bible. There, Protestants are well above the national sample. The national sample, the question is, do you read the Bible frequently? 60% of the people say they do. 68% of the Protestants say they do. 44% of Catholics say they do. And 35% of Jews say they do. And that's easily intelligible. Why, there's something in even the most secularized Protestant tradition that makes people believe they read the Bible frequently. This is not to be taken as an indication of how frequently they read the Bible. This is to be taken as an indication of what they believe about how frequently they read the Bible. It's quite a different thing. But that's a very powerful factor. If people define it, as W.I. Thomas once said, and that's a kind of a golden rule for all sociologists, if a situation is defined as real, it is real in its consequences. Now, when we get to religious education, everybody's so much in favor of it, and it's departmental discrimination. 98% of the American people say they're in favor of religious education for the children. They have the most diverse ideas to what religious education is like. And when you get down to a more limited question, are you in favor of the religious or parochial school, the all-day school under the church auspices, you know? And only 25% of the national sample say they're in favor of it. 74% of Catholics are in favor of it. Only 12% of Protestants, although the figure, this is a decade ago, the figure is much higher now, I'm sure. And 40% of Jews say they're in favor of it. I would say the proportion of Jews must now be 50 or 60%. In other words, there, the Catholics are most in favor of it, Jews next, and Protestants least. And why do we suppose that is the case? That is why we really have to explain not why Catholics and Jews are so much in favor of it, although I worry about the Jews being in place, but why are Protestants so little in favor of it?
Yes, and the public schools are actually banned for all.
That's all right. That's exactly it. They haven't gotten over the notion that public schools ought to be really Protestant parochial schools. And in fact, they have been. And I would say in large part of the country, perhaps the major part of the country, they still are. Protestants have gotten used to feeling that the public schools are their schools. Therefore, they don't feel a sense of separate school. But this is diminishing. And therefore, Protestant interest in church schools is increasing. You see the point here. Now, for Jews, this is primarily a matter of keeping the children Jewish. It's very anomalous that 9/10 of the day schools, they're called day schools, these Jewish schools, elementary or high schools under religious auspices, are called day schools, which means really the contraction of all day schools. 9/10 of the day schools are the work of the Orthodox, sometimes even the extremely Orthodox. But the children who attend are only in the minority Orthodox. The parents, of course, pick up a serious problem in this case, but they trust unconsciously to the fact that what is learned in school is very evanescent. and disappear while the attitude required the school remained, you see. The reform, conservative parents, reform parents, and some of us heard children get orthodox beliefs, not because they're getting orthodox beliefs, but children come home and say, look, look what I said to school, look what they're doing. They know the discrepancy. But this passes while the children remain Jewish. The anxiety of remaining Jewish is I think, exactly. Children remain Jewish anyway, other due to immense social pressures. But this is not what Jewish parents believe. They believe that it's necessary to do something really drastic to keep them Jewish, for they remember their own child. You see? And that's the main reason. And another factor is that these day schools are, without almost our exception, superior schools. Far superior to 75% of the public schools, the comparable public schools. But even there are cases in New Jersey, for example, where non-Jews send their children to the Jewish day school because it's their schools. Just as there are cases in Washington, D.C., for example, where Jewish parents, and even among the most important rabbis in the Washington community, in fact, the most important one, sends his children to the Episcopal High School, St. Olaf School, because it's a good school, and because there are other faculty of the which you cannot find in the Washington High School. Well, you can't find a lot of other things in Washington High School, but this is not unknown, and it's not unusual in many cases. Any question on this? Now, next question is, you want the children to be raised as church members. Now, this doesn't mean you want the children to be religious. Everybody wants children to be religious. It means you want the children to be taken into the church community while they're still children. Instead of, as the progressive-minded people used to say, wait till they grow up and they make up their own minds, you know. Meanwhile, they live as a fan animation. Well, 72% of American people say yes, they want their children to be raised as church members. That doesn't mean that the others don't want their children to be church members. They just have the old permissive feeling. You see? Children here mean children 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. Catholics 91%, Protestants 67%, Jews 67%. Any question on this? Now, the eighth question was religion and marriage. This is one of the most complex questions there is. And the form in which the question is asked varies. And the usual question is, do you think that people have a greater chance of happiness if they're of one faith? Or do you think that marrying outside their faith prejudices the chance of happiness? Or something like that. Now, we'll take this simply as in favor or against religious intermarriage, whatever the question is. The question, there's been a high correlation between the answers given to the very form of the question, and therefore the form of the question don't matter much. The people really don't answer the question, they answer their feeling about intermarriage. Now, the nation, 75% are against religious intermarriage. I mean, they said I just mentioned, and that they think it's not a good thing. Who do you think is most opposed to intermarriage of the three groups?
Jews.
Jews. Who do you think is least opposed to intermarriage? What? No, wrong characters. The lay people. Now, actually, Jews are most opposed, over 80%. Say that it answers no to various questions. And what is more important, or what is just equally important, is that conservative and orthodox rabbis will never perform a mixed marriage, a religiously mixed marriage. There are no dispensations. There are no three reasons. No. Now, reform used to perform mixed marriages, reform rabbis, I got it out of many do it now. There's a very wrong feeling about mixed marriage. That means religion mixed marriage. There's no impediment if the other partner becomes Jewish, you see. No impediment whatever.
You understand?
But Jews mixed marriage, and Jews are most opposed to mixed marriage, and significantly opposed. Now, Protestants, about 76% national sample, practically. 75% is national sample, 70% Protestants. Catholics are way below the national sample. They're about 70%, which means 30% do not say, do not express any opposition or any feeling against it. It's a very high thing. Remember that Protestant practice varies. In some denominations, ministers will marry, will perform mixed marriages, or they won't. Catholic practice is uniform. Canon law forbids a mixed marriage, just as halakha forbids a mixed marriage for the Jews. But, whereas the Orthodox conservative Jews will not allow any dispensation, the rabbis, ruling on the canon law does allow dispensation. If certain conditions are met, and these conditions I call the antinuptial agreement, which has to be signed in advance by the non-Catholic father. And the two significant elements of the antinuptial agreement are that the non-Catholic partner will not try to subvert the faith of the Catholic partner, and second, that children will be brought up in the Catholic Church. If this is agreed to, if this dispensation is forthcoming, and the marriage is performed validly according to Catholic, according to the sacrament of marriage. Now, why is it, though, that the Catholic lay people, and this is, of course, a requirement for the attitude of the lay people, because the mass of people are the lay people, are least opposed to marriage. Why is that? On this, there is no question. Results are so surprising that not many checks were made and found uniformity in the case. Why is that so? Why should that be so? Go
ahead. Itself to one of the
denominations. Yeah, but so far from the other one of the denominations. And the Jews certainly don't regard as one of many many religions.
They would be threatened, though, so they definitely will have the other hand.
Yeah, well, that would then suggest that the priest should be in favor of the marriage, not only the priest of faith. And that assumes that the concern of the Catholic, lay Catholic, is the preservation and increase of the Catholic fold. That's rather an exorbitant assumption, don't you think?
Would this be a defensive position against being called all sectarian or?
No, because the very same people are sometimes very clannish people. No, it's a factor that will be obvious for you once I mention it. Until recently, intermarriage with Protestants, that is, usually Catholic girls, 9,000 boys, was one of the most effective ways of upward mobility, of advancing in social status. Catholics were a foreign, lower class, marginal group. Nothing could advance a Catholic family, and certainly the girl, more than marrying a middle or upper middle class Protestant boy. Now, this explanation illuminated by an answer given by one of these cases studied. There was a Catholic mother, Irish Catholic mother, in Brooklyn, and that's pretty clannish. It's pretty clannish neighborhood. Her daughter was going to marry a Protestant boy who had just graduated from Columbia Law School, and they were moving out to the suburbs. And she was asked about this. She said, yeah, I know, the priest won't like it, but look what it'll do for Mamie. But Mamie, it'll do an immense amount. You see? In other words, I would suggest that the mother was worried more about Mamie than about the preservation and enlargement of the church. Well, which is the custom of mothers. Now that factor cannot be ignored. It is a very powerful factor. It operated upon Jews too, in this second generation of Jews, that secured the middle class status without such devices. And I think Catholic intermarriage will somewhat, Jewish intermarriage has definitely declined in the third generation. Catholic intermarriage will probably decline in the next decade. In fact, Lenski, who studied remember the deportment problem area, Gary Lenski, the religious factor, found, and that's heavily Catholic, found no tendency to increase religious intermarriage at all. Against some of the Catholics, sociologist like Father Thomas, who found such increase. He found no increase whatever. And actually, that's the problem. He found a decrease, but he wasn't sure of a decrease. He let it go at no increase. Now, are there any questions? Any question on this? Now, we're going to close this part with a quotation from an interesting article. Well, here somewhere. Here, I have a reprint of it. Religion and Secularization by W. Stuart Salisbury, published in Social Forces. And he reaches several conclusions very appropriate to this course. But one conclusion is appropriate to this point right now. He says, in terms of both experience and attitudes, Catholics are the most religious and least secular, Protestants rank next, while Jews are the least religious and most secular. Now this is a mental inquiry quite different from what I use. Entirely different. He was studying groups of students. He wasn't making one of those public opinion surveys. Started by the vast organization. He has here all of the various, all of the documentation that's available in this article. I think we can take this for granted. It's a very interesting situation, and of course, it's not valid as a universal rule. For example, in East Europe, let's say in the 1920s, in Poland, the Jews would have been the most religious group. This is characteristic of America now, and not the universal rule, you see? Any questions? Any questions on this whole area? On the cross comparisons. Now I want to shift to the problem of religious group tensions in present-day America. Examine the tensions. But here I will proceed in an unusual way. I have before me a paper, this is really proof of an article up here, a paper I presented on two different occasions. One was at a conference called by San Francisco Theological Seminary, which is Presbyterian. And the other through the faculty conference of the Cardinal de Rochelle, which is Catholic. And out of the Hispanic gap. And I will read this paper, but take it as though I were talking, and you can interrupt me whenever you like. It's not as though you have to hear the paper and then ask questions. And just keep on asking questions the same way. It's much more convenient and easier for me to follow the argument in the best prepared form rather than in the form and not so well organized. Any question on so far, before I begin this? Now, the first few minutes of this will serve as a kind of summary of our basic thesis. Religious group conflict in contemporary America reflects the changing shape of American pluralism. And this pluralism is today essentially religious. In some sense, all societies, even the most monolithic, have been pluralistic. For there has never been a society without a wide diversity of interests, opinions, and conditions of life. Yet when we speak of a pluralistic society, we mean something more. We mean a society in which diversity not only exists, as a matter of fact, but are recognized, accepted, perhaps even institutionalized into the structure and functioning of the social order. In this sense, American society is thoroughly pluralistic, but pluralistic in a very special way, with its own characteristic freedoms and restrictions. shape of American pluralism helps define the underlying pattern of American life within which emerge the so-called intergroup problems that confront us today in such a variety of spheres and forms. The pluralism of American society is a product of its history and therefore reflects its inmost being. For the inmost being of men and their societies is essentially historical. From the very beginning, America has been a land of diversity, striving for unity. And from the very beginning, too, the diversities have been radical. They have been racial, ethnic, cultural, and religious, whereas the unity striven for has been that of a new way of life, reflecting the new order of things. Established in the new world. This was the vision that fired the imagination of Hector de Crèvecoeur, the author of the celebrated Letters from an American Farmer, who was so eager to interpret the new American reality to the new and old world alike. Here, Crèvecoeur proclaimed, 1572, individuals of all nations are melted into a new race of men, whose labors and prosperity will one day cause great changes in the world. Thus early was the melting pot philosophy explicitly formulated, and thus early did the problem of unity amidst diversity, and diversity amidst unity, emerge as the perennial problem of American life. The conception applied in the image of the melting pot has always been subject to a misunderstanding that is itself not without significance. When, at least until recently, Americans spoke of the melting pot, they generally had in mind a process by which the foreign peculiarities of language and culture, which the immigrants brought with them from the old country, would be sloughed off in the course of Americanization, and new, homogeneous, undifferentiated type of America would come to be. Against this, the apostles of their cultural pluralism protested. They stressed the richness of the immigrant culture, deplore their threatening dissolution, and advocated a multicultural, even a multinational society along familiar European lines. Both the theorists of the melting pot and the cultural pluralists gravely misunderstood the emerging patterns of American pluralism. For American pluralism, through all its changes and mutations, has remained characteristically American, quite unlike the pluralistic patterns prevailing in other parts of the world. The source of diversity have been different, and the expressions of it even more so. By and large, we may say that since the latter part of the 19th century, the source of American pluralism have been mainly race, ethnicity, and religion, with section or region playing a diminishing, though in some cases still not in a significant role. It is in terms of these that Americans have tended and still tend to define their identities amidst the totality of American life. The process of enculturation perpetuates the pattern. When asked a simple question, what are you, Gordon W. Allporter has noted, referring to certain recent researchers, only 10% of four-year-olds answer in terms of racial, ethnic, or religious membership, whereas 75% of nine-year-olds do so. Race in America today, means color, white versus non-white, and racial stigmatization has introduced an element of caste-like stratification into American life. For white Americans, ethnicity and religion have been and still remain the major sources of pluralistic diversity, though the relation between them has changed drastically in the course of the past generation. It is this change that provides a clue to an understanding of the shape of present-day American pluralism and of the nature and sources of religious group conflict in present-day America. As long as large-scale immigration continued and America was predominantly a land of immigrants, in the days when the immigrants war in American history, as Oscar Hammer puts it, the dominant form of self-identification, and therefore the dominant form of pluralistic diversity, was immigrant ethnicity. Religion was felt to be part of the ethnic heritage, recent or remote. The enthusiasts of the melting pot were eager to eliminate this diversity as quickly as possible. The cultural pluralists were determined to perpetuate it. But both alike moved within the framework of a pluralism based substantially on ethnicity, ethnic culture, and ethnic religion. Within the past generation, the picture has changed radically. The stoppage of mass immigration during World War I, followed by the anti-immigration legislation of the 1920s, undermined the foundations of the immigrant ethnic group with amazing rapidity. What it did was to facilitate the emergence of a third and post-third American generations with their characteristic responses and attitudes, had a decisive influence in American life, no longer threatened with submergence by the next wave of immigration. This far-reaching structural change had, of course, been reflected in the shape and form of American pluralism. Specifically, within the threefold American scheme of race, ethnicity, and religion, a shift has taken place from ethnicity to religion as a dominant form of self-identification, and therefore also the dominant form of pluralistic diversity. Ethnic identification and tradition have now altogether disappeared. On the contrary, with the third generation, as Marcus Lee Hansen has quotably shown, they enjoy a large popularity as symbols of heritage. But the relation of ethnicity and religion has been reversed. Religion is no longer taken as an aspect of ethnicity. It is ethnicity, or rather, what remains of it, that is taken up, refined, and expressed through religious identifications and institutions. Religion, or at least the tripartite differentiation of Protestant, Catholic, Jew, has, aside from race, become the characteristic form of pluralistic diversity in American life. American pluralism is today, again, aside from race, characteristically the religious pluralism. And all problems of American unity and diversity, cooperation and conflict, have to be interpreted in the light of this great fact. This shift from ethnicity to religion is well documented in the recent and most impressive of community surveys, particularly concerned with religion. The Detroit Metropolitan Area Survey in 1958, recorded and interpreted by Gerhard Lenski in the Religious Factor. Among the possible trends cited above, Lenski states in his concluding chapter, one deserves special comment, both because of its far-reaching implications and because many of these implications have received so little attention from the general public. This is the trend toward increased socio-religious communalism. As we know in Chapter 2, communalism along socio-religious group lines seems to have been gaining in strength in recent years and promises to continue to gain in the foreseeable future. This development is one which has been greatly hastened by the rapid decline of the older ethnic sub-communities in recent years. Until about a generation ago, the American population was sharply divided into a rather large number of relatively small ethnic sub-communities. These groups, however, were unable to preserve their organizational integrity in the face of their powerful and pervasive pressures to American identity. And intermarriage across ethnic group lines has now become quite common. The successor of the ethnic sub-community is the socio-religious sub-community. There seems to be little doubt that socio-religious groups are rapidly replacing ethnic groups as the basic units in the system of status groups in American society. Such is the emerging shape of American pluralism, within which intergroup conflicts today arise and take their course. It is a religious pluralism, a pluralism defined in terms of religious identity. identification and belonging. But American pluralism, it has often been noted, is not simply plurality, it is also unity. It is a fact best designated by the term plurality. A unity of plurality as well as plurality and unity. A pluribus unum, this phrase, which was originally employed to celebrate the unification of the 13 colonies into the new nation, will serve very well as a formula for American pluralism as that has developed through the decades since the Civil War. What is this unity that supplies the centripetal force in American life, or to change the image, the common framework within which the pluralistic allegiances find both their freedom and their limits? This unity is the unity of the American way of life. It is not easy to put into words just what the American way of life is, or how it functions to provide the overall unity for the pluralistic diversity of American society. Perhaps the most important thing to say about it is that by virtue is, and perhaps the most important thing to say about it is that for the American way of life is that by virtue of which he is an American. Americans with their incredible diversity of race, culture, and national origin find their unity, their common Americans, in their adherence to and participation in the American way of life. This provides them their common allegiance and their common faith. It provides them, to use the words of the sociologist Robin F. Williams Jr., with a common set of ideas, rituals, and symbols by which an overarching sense of unity is achieved amidst diversity and color. If the pluralism of contemporary American society is primarily a religious pluralism, the unity within which this pluralism is expressed and contained is a unity of the American way of life. Religious group conflict in contemporary America is a conflict within this overarching unity. Now, this is the first section. Are there any questions? This is really the basic thesis of the entire course. Any questions about that? And I can go on to the second section, which deals with Protestant-Catholic tensions, so the facts and factors. Because American pluralism today is basically a religious pluralism, the tensions that affect the religious communities would seem to be of special importance for the future of America and the unity of its people. It is these tensions that you'd like to discuss, particularly the Protestant-Catholic tensions, which concern us most immediately, but also Jewish-Gentile tensions, which, though at the moment not very prominent, we can't altogether ignore. When I say I'm going to discuss Protestant-Catholic tensions, I do not mean that I'm going to take up all the various matters that are alleged to be an issue between Protestants and Catholics in this country. Now, actually, after we discuss this paper, I will take up some of those issues as illustrations. Not that these matters are not real and important. They are. They are real and important. But there are two considerations we should bear in mind. First, these questions at issue, however real and important, do not seem to me to be so much the core of the tensions as their expression. They are not merely questions under discussion, they are what we call issues. They become issues precisely because they arise in an already established context of tension and become vehicles of this tension and conflict. Is that clear, the point I'm making here? That these issues, these questions that issue between Protestant Catholics or lesbian issues, not Catholics, are however real and important, are not the causes of attention, but the expression of vehicle of attention. They become issues, that is something to be followed, because they arise in an already established context of tension. Any question on this? Secondly, these controversial questions, even though they become issues in Protestants and Catholics, and Jews too, for that matter, are rarely, if ever, questions on which one group is aligned all on one side and the other group all on the other side. On the contrary, matter on every one of these questions. There are differences and divisions in each of the three religious communities, with sizable minorities in each group crossing the lines. Only in a very limited sense can it be said that the three religious groups have their special social and cultural outlooks, conflict over which is engendering the group tensions we have to serve. Is that one clear? I'll be obvious and I'll illustrate later on. The real sources of religious group tension in America today, in the America today, seem to me to be emphatically pre-ideological. That is, a line on a level before ideologies have happened. Although, no doubt, they are quickly rationalized and ideologized. The tensions we are concerned with, particularly the Protestant Catholic tensions, seem to me to emerge from a number of closely related social changes on the way in this country today, with far-reaching repercussions upon the religious situation. The first of these basic social changes directly affecting religious group relations is the transformation of America within the present generation from a Protestant nation to a three religious country. Writing just about 35 years ago, André Siegfried, the French observer, described Protestantism as America's national religion. And he was largely right, despite the ban on his establishment in the Constitution. Normally, to be born American in those days meant to be a Protestant. This was the religious identification that quite naturally and appropriately went along with being in America. Non-Protestants felt the force of this conviction almost as strongly as did the Protestants. Catholics and Jews, despite their vastly increasing numbers, experienced their non-Protestant religion as a problem, even as an obstacle to their becoming full-fledged Americans. It was a mark of their forests. Protestantism, not any of the multiplying denominations of Protestantism as a whole, was America's established church. The others, the non-Protestants, were to some degree and in varying measure, outsiders. America was a Protestant nation. This is no longer the case. Today, unlike 50 years ago, the natural and appropriate religious belonging that goes along with being an American is not simply being a Protestant. It is, as the evidence amply shows, being a Protestant, being a Catholic, or being a Jew. These have become the three ways of being religious in the American way. As indeed they have become the three ways of being an American. Today, Catholics and Jews, as well as Protestants, feel themselves to be Americans not apart from or in spite of their religion, but because of it. If America today possesses an established church in Siegfried's sense, it is the emerging tripartite system of Protestant Catholic Jew. Whereas Justice Sullivan in the 1920s could still speak of America as a Christian nation, Justice Douglas in the 1950s spoke of Americans as a religious people whose institution presupposed a supreme being. From a Protestant nation, we have become a three religion country. And this transformation is the consequence not of any marked increase of Catholics or Jews in the population, but an accompaniment of the shift we have been discussing in the pattern of self-identification, and therefore also the source of pluralistic diversity from ethnicity to religion. Any question on this? We've gone over this several times, and this is in a sense a review. The second factor I should like to mention is closely related to the first. It is the transformation of American Catholics, again largely within our generation, from a peripheral, far lower class group into a nuclear, middle class American community. The remarkable upward mobility of the Catholic groups in the course of the past generation has been well presented and documented in Father Andrew Greeley's report to the International Conference of Religious Sociology held in Brussels last June. And I will not use any of my limited time to substantiate it. I will merely emphasize once more the importance of this fact and its close relation to the emergence of a free religious America. Now, what has been, what are the consequences of these two interconnected prophecies for the religious situation, especially in terms of Protestant Catholic tensions? I think it must be said that these two major social developments are having a discernible double effect, making at one and the same time for an exacerbation and a mitigation of these tensions, though at different range. In brief, it seems to me that their effect has been in the short run to aggravate tensions, but in the long run to reduce and alleviate. Let us consider the latter side first, the long run. Through the concomitant operation of both of these tendencies I have mentioned, Catholicism has become a legitimate part of American religion, one of the three great faiths, with an assured place in the American scheme of things. And Catholics have become, perhaps I should say are becoming, good middle-class Americans, a recognized part of the American people. To increasing numbers of Protestants, especially younger Protestants, Catholics have become, are becoming, our kind of people, embraced in the total formula of American comprehension. After all, we're all Americans. I shall have occasion to develop this point a little later. For the present, it is enough to bring it to the fore and emphasize how strongly it makes for the mitigation of Protestant Catholic strains and tensions in the long run. Any question about this? The long run mitigation. Because Catholics have become our kind of people, embraced in the formula, after all, we're all Americans. Do you follow what I'm saying there? Any question on this? But the very same process that promises in the long run to mitigate these strange intentions would seem very much to exacerbate them in the short run. Why this double and contradictory effect? Consider the position of the Protestant, particularly the middle age or older Protestant, in present-day America. His whole outlook was shaped, his whole mind was formed, his feelings were articulated in an America that was a Protestant nation. Let me repeat that. His whole outlook was shaped, his mind was formed, his feelings were articulated in an America that was a Protestant nation. And he was America. Now he finds himself propelled into a post-Protestant America, into a free religious country, where he is not the nation, but merely one of three. Suddenly he finds himself faced with the threat of a lost and accustomed status, a privileged status long endured and taken for granted, is being subverted before his very eyes. He feels himself dispossessed. The Catholics, and Jews too, have moved in on him and taken over what was once his. He feels himself threatened. Catholics are multiplying prodigiously and are about to take over the country. This nightmare of Catholic domination is not in the least warranted by the facts, but it has no significant logic. Whereas Roman Catholic growth in the country as a whole has been relatively moderate, what one may call the Roman Catholic presence has grown prodigiously. There was a time when the mass of Catholics were the lower classes, at the margin of society. Laborers and servant girls, hewers of wood and drawers of water. see them as a threat. Indeed, in good times, he hardly knows their existence, for they were not present in a nuclear institution of the community. Within the past generation, however, the extraordinary upward mobility of American Catholics has converted large numbers of these Catholics into solid middle-class Americans and has brought them in mounting proportions into these very nuclear institutions. No wonder the old-line Protestant, with his older attitudes, feels himself surrounded and threatened. Wherever he turns, in those very places he has been accustomed to regard as his own, the nuclear middle-class institution and organization of the community, he finds more and more of these Catholics who, for him, remember, are still outside of the interlopers. No wonder he finds himself terrified at the specter of Catholic domination. Is that one clear? Any questions? He also resents what he thinks of as Catholic divisiveness. As a minority group, Catholics were early constrained to build up separate Catholic community organizations to protect themselves and to advance their interests in the fierce group competition always so characteristic of American life. And so we have the vast proliferation of Catholic separatist organizations, from the early Irish Catholic Protective Society to the Association of Catholic Lawyers and Firemen and Policemen and Veterans and Educators and so on and on today. In this respect, Catholics have behaved very much as did the other minority groups in this country, Jews, Negroes, Catholic emancipation. Remember the story about the emancipation when they went into a real upsurge of self-organization. And first and second generation immigrants who all felt the need for separate community organizations and quickly developed them. But of course, in the older days, Protestants felt no such need and took no such action until well into this generation. The general community institutions and organizations were in fact Protestant institutions and organizations. Because this was a Protestant nation and a Protestant culture. In the course of the past generation, the situation has been changing drastically. This is no longer a Protestant nation. And Protestants are today only one of three. Protestants can no longer count on the general community institutions and organizations as theirs. So that in effect, they find themselves organizationally and institutionally disarmed in the face of the tightening Jewish and Catholic communities. You get this point. This is a source of real problem. The natural, what I say the normal response of most Protestants has been to denounce the whole system of separate community institutions as divisive and un-American, despite the fact that it fits in very well with the emerging power of American religious communalism and actually operates as an integrated factor in American life. A growing number of Protestants, however, are coming to recognize the harsh fact of the situation and are proceeding, though haltingly, to build up their own Protestant communal institutions in a new free religion in America. In this, they are being prompted by the Negro Protestants, who, though Protestants, have never had America their own, and have therefore been forced from the very beginning to elaborate a system of separate Negro institutions and organizations. Is that point clear now? This is a very crucial point in the current situation. Any questions? Yes.
I just want to be sure I've got it right. You said Protestants for so long had civil institutions for their own.
The community institutions, no.
This has prompted a laziness of mind.
Well, not laziness of mind. They didn't see a necessity. These separate organizations might have been necessary for foreigners and outsiders, but not for them. You see, the foreigners and outsiders, the Jews, the Catholics, and the Negroes, needed these from the very beginning
you would say that the Protestant organization within the civil institution was perhaps just as tight, if not tighter, than the Catholic
well,
and Jewish
Well, of course, one of the fact that nobody paid any attention to it, they took for granted. The Grand Army of the Republic, which was the American Legion of the Civil War, never had a Catholic chaplain. Although thousands and perhaps hundreds of thousands, scores of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Catholic servants in the forces, the chaplain was always Protestant. What else would it be? You see what I mean? But this situation has changed. And Protestants, in this same situation, find themselves without armament as against the other community that have the armament. Now, in natural responses, this is all wicked. It's un-American and divisive. But this is just grumbling. It doesn't have a side effect because what the other communities have is not only a part of their past history, but it reflects the present structure of American society. You know, the tripartite social religious communalism, as Leslie calls it. Therefore, Protestants unwillingly, haltingly, have different places, different races, and because they don't have their own institutions, their own community institutions. I think that Protestant council would have been in the intelligible 100 years ago, 50 years ago. Or in St. George's Society of Policemen, the Protestant Policemen Society in New York. You see what I mean there? Now, in spite of the fact that they're building up their own community institutions, they're way behind. And they still regard this whole system as the work of the devil. I mean, the work of the fathers. And they still bear a grudge against the Catholics and the Jews for having introduced this kind of wickedness to America. Although America was always organized in terms of community. Though the communities were regional ones, kind of the constitution. And you read the federal papers, there was great diversity with the defensive organization, but they were regional. Not ethnic or religious, you see. America was never homogeneous unity, never. Diversity was always diverse in American life, and the tension of diverse groups in America was always the case, as you can see from reading federal statement number 10 in Madison's paper. Any question on this? But this is a case that creates a shock and a trauma in the Protestant countries. Remember, they've been Protestant, the older Protestants feel they've been dispossessed, they feel they're surrounded, overwhelmed, they feel that America is being ruined by this kind of divisiveness. You get the point there. Any questions? Well, we can go on. It is not necessary to extend this argument. It seems to me very clear. The rapid shift in social structure involved in the emergence of a free religion America has imposed heavy strains on the Protestant mind and on Protestant attitudes, and has resulted among large numbers of the older Protestants in a feverish anti-Catholicism. This has been clearly recognized by many Protestant leaders themselves. Some years ago, the then editor of the Christian Century, that was Theodore Gipp, who's now the president of the San Francisco Theological Seminary, where I registered first. Some years ago, the then editor of the Christian Century adverted this problem in a powerful editorial entitled Protestant, Be Yourself, at the Christian Century, October 1955. In which he characterized this frenetic attitude as Protestant paranoia. No, that's his phrase. Lest this characterization seem to be outrageously extreme, permit me to quote a passage in an editorial from the very same Christian Century, 3 years before, December 31, 1952, when the publication was under a different definition, a very different definition. The worst mistake the new Eisenhower administration could make, short of plunging the world into an atomic war, the Christian Century pronounced editorially, would be to attempt to send an ambassador to the Vatican. Number two calamity for the universe. When sending an ambassador to the Vatican can be regarded as number two calamity in the universe, it would seem that Protestant paranoia is not too strong. But if we can speak of Protestant paranoia, we must not forget the corresponding affliction of Catholics, which the Christian Center editorial has very aptly called Catholic claustrophobia. If many Protestants reveal the effects of a desperate anxiety over the threat of loss to their accustomed status, Catholics are status anxious in another sense, in the sense of being anxious over the preservation of their newly acquired status. They feel hemmed, closed in. They are suspicious and touched, discovering everywhere evidence that their higher power, newly achieved status, is not being properly or adequately acknowledged by the others. In this, curiously enough, they are very much like the famous Texas millionaires, who too feel that their newly achieved status is not being adequately recognized by the intellectuals and the society snobs. They got the money, but what of it? Their wives still can't move the best society, no matter how many minutes they got. They still feel themselves deprived and the have-nots. They, the Catholics, still uneasy in the new tripartite scheme of American life, are easily tempted to self-assertiveness and to assuming postures of uneasy superiority. And above all, they tend to overcompensate. Here again, it is not necessary to extend the argument. If we take these phrases, Protestant paranoia and Catholic claustrophobia, as no more than figures of speech, we must recognize how apt they are in describing the attitudes of large numbers of Protestants and Catholics in the present day changing religious social situation. It is out of these attitudes, in their context, that the strains and tensions emerge which characterize religious group relations in this country today. In this supercharged emotional atmosphere, almost any question of social policy may easily become a matter of a bit of controversy in our circle. Any questions on this point? Any questions? But within this situation of strain and tension, there are profound differences of attitude, almost if not quite as important as the overall situation itself. The first, and perhaps the most significant kind of difference, is difference of generation. Difference of generation. It is widely known that the younger people of all religious groups show a far less hostile attitude, a far less rigid attitude than do the older people of their communities. This is often set down to their youth, which is supposed to keep the young people more flexible, or to their education, which is supposed to render them more tolerant. Whatever truth there may be in these allegations, they cannot point to the main factor. For if it were only youth, there would be no law rate shift. What with the younger people becoming older and therefore allegedly assuming less flexible attitudes? But such a law rate shift there definitely is. Nor, or simply education, would there be any difference between the younger people and their elders in the same educational background? But such difference there is. The explanation must be sought somewhat deeper. Every election year since 1940, as well as the points in between, the American Institute of Public Opinion, the Gallup, has asked the same question. If your party nominated a qualified man for the presidency this year, and he happened to be a Catholic, would you vote him? Your party is qualified, but he happened to be a Catholic. Would you vote him? Here's a breakdown by age groups of the 1956 return. 1960, a Catholic was elected. The age group are 21, 29, 39, 30 to 49, 50 and over. They don't go below 21 because people can't vote below 21. This is supposed to be a voter's response. Yes, I will vote for it. 83% of the young group 69% of the middle group, 62% of the old group.
Any difference? 83% 62%? Not that. A 25% decline. You get the point?
No, we will not go there. That is, those are anti-capital. Simply because of anti-capital. 14% of the young group, 17% of the middle-aged group, 31% of the older group, 50 and over. It's an amazing difference from 14 to 31. 5% increase. Overall, do you realize that? Actually, the younger and the middle group are pretty much the same. It's the older group that is to show the great diversity, the great difference. You hear that on TV shows. 100% difference. Twice as many in proportion, more than twice as many in proportion as 50 and over, would not vote for a man simply because of the Catholic, as in 20, as a group in 21 to 29. Any question on this? That's a breakdown from 1956. At the same time, let's examine the long wage spread, 1940-1956. That's 60 years. Four election years, five election years. 40, 44, 48, 52. And then it's more than that. Yeah, 52 and 56. Five election years. Whereas 1940, yes, those would vote for an even going to capital. While 62% in 1936 was 73%. A marked increase of those who would vote for capital. The no is pretty well decisive. In 1940, 31% of the electorate said they would not vote for that simply because of the capital. In 1986, only 22%. There's a one-third decline. And of course, the no opinions shifted from, and fell from, 7 to 5. It's interesting that in go back to the earlier figures, I mean the fixed figures, I mean the one I gave a minute ago. Whereas in the group between 21 and 29, only 3% had no opinion. In the group of 50 and over, 7% had no opinion. No opinion is notorious that no opinion often is a way of evading a direct statement. Clearly, the people over 50, some of them are small group, but some of them didn't want to say they were anti-Catholic, but didn't want to say they were open anyway, so they said that openly. 7%, I think that's 3%. Anti-Catholic bias has been and is considerably lower in the youngest age group than the oldest. At the same time, too, such anti-Catholic bias was considerably lower among the people as a whole in 1956 than it was in 1940. And in 1960, a Catholic president was elected the first time in office. It seems to me evident that the younger people see things in a rather different way from the older. And this less biased attitude, if you can call it that, persists after they become older. Otherwise, living a long way from. It appears to be not so much a matter of age as a religio-social climate of opinion in which the mind has been formed. The older generation came out of Protestant America, the Catholics were largely regarded as foreigners and outsiders. The younger people have come out of a free religion America, where Catholics are our kind of people, and Americans like us. On the issue of federal aid to parochial schools, the Gallup poll conducted in 1949 indicated that, quote, the greatest acceptance of the Catholic argument must be found among the young voters of all religions. Very much the same was revealed in a survey, and yet unpublished, of public opinion in a New England town, which had become more than half Catholic in the course of less than 30 years. It had been an almost entire Protestant town. In 30 years, it became more than half Catholic. There was a great hue and cry about the Catholic menace in that town. But the survey indicated that it was largely limited to Protestants and Jews over 45 years of age. Very few of the younger people saw any menace at all. They were well aware that Catholics were multiplying in the town, but they refused to be thrown into a panic by that. Their Catholic response was, so what? We're all Americans, aren't we? Martin Markey, found something very similar among Lutheran groups in the Midwest. Here is how he is quoted in the New York Times for September 19th, 1960. You know who Martin Murray is? He's an associate editor of the Christian Century and Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor, and a man of great intellectual parts. The Reverend Dr. Martin Murray, an Lutheran pastor, author, and editor, made an observation, that's the New York Times, and that had cropped up in other interviews in the South and Midwest in the last month. It was that in the church themselves, it was primarily the older generation of Protestants who were raising cries against a Catholic for president. The younger generation, he said, is not so dead set on preserving the old Protestant domination. In other words, the older part of America is passing. But it is naturally only the younger generation which is having much success in adjusting itself to the post-Protestant materialistic country. This is one of the chief reasons for the present exacerbation of tensions. But it is also a very good reason for expecting a considerable alleviation of these tensions in the coming years. For, as the younger generation formed materialism in America comes to constitute the mass of the nation, those attitudes that are now the special attitudes of the younger generation are bound to become the dominant attitudes of the American people. In this lies our best hope, but there's still a hope for the future. Generational differences are not the only differences worth noting. It is a familiar fact that Protestant-Catholic relations are best and most amicable on the highest theological levels, where a genuine religious dialogue is beginning to emerge. Anti-Catholic bias among Protestants and anti-Protestant bias among Catholics would seem to be worse among those whose religious life is most primitive and is most indiscriminately identified with their own culture. Or perhaps a qualification ought to be made. The most virulent anti-Catholicism is to be found among secularistic-minded liberals, for whom Catholicism still represents Voltaire's last God, Israel's one, in the sea. The quintessence of dogmatic institutional religion to be formed in the name of enlightenment. As Peter Beerick has well put it, Catholic thinking is the anti-Semitism of the liberals. The Kennedy campaign, for a time, disrupted this syndrome, but recently has been showing signs of recovering its old vigor, easily fusing with the more common anti-Catholicism long endemic in this country. Any questions? Any questions on this analysis? Any questions? Everything clear? All right, I'm going to go on to the third section, Jewish-Gentile relations. A word now about Jewish-Gentile relations. Before I attempt to bring the various threads together to a conclusion, although there are a number of communities, particularly in suburbia, where Jewish-Gentile relations exhibit the same kind of tensions as characterized Protestant-Catholic relations elsewhere, it seems to be generally agreed that what is usually, though I think inaccurately, called anti-Semitism, is that they are the lowest ebb in honesty, the lowest ebb in honesty. It is hard to explain just why this should be so, but I will venture a guess or two. It seems to me that something happened during the last war that produced a sharp change in the American mind. In that war, we faced Hitler, not only as a national enemy, but as the incarnation of evil. And the name of that evil was anti-Semitism or racialism. Since the war, Americans, especially younger Americans, have been very uneasy about anything that smacks of race or ethnicity. Even the good side. God is the minstrel show that has become so much a part of American entertainment. Gone too are the musty old ethnic jokes. What survives, at least in public, is a pale and genteel imitation of the genuine artist. Anti
anti-Semitism has come to be regarded not merely as unenlightened, but as positively indecent, and what is more, un-American as well. Even those who have anti-Semitic feelings, and there are, of course, many millions of such people in our country, even they find it difficult to acknowledge it, to acknowledge it, even to themselves, let alone to others. As I said, anti-Semitism, at least overt anti-Semitism, has become un-American. This development has been considerably aided by the fact that in the course of the past generation, Jews, American Jews, even more than Catholics, have been in increasing numbers, become good, solid, well-educated, American-minded Americans. Jews on their part, especially the older generation, still retain something of the older attitude, expressed in an almost neurotic defensiveness. Jews still see themselves, in fact, most threatened by Roman Catholics, though recent political and social causes have thrown them together quite closely. And Jews, particularly the spokesmen of Jewish institutions and organizations, seem to insist on thoroughgoing separation of church and state, that is, on the thoroughgoing secularization of public life. This attitude is shared even by Jews who are themselves deeply religious in their private lives. This curious duality, which has brought Jewish organizations in repeated conflict with Roman Catholic and much of Protestant opinion, seems to be due to the conviction, widely held, though not often articulated, that because the Western Jew achieved emancipation with the secularization of society, he can preserve his free and equal status only so long as culture and society remain thoroughly secular. It is easy to understand these fears, and it is easy to see how they engender that curious Jewish schizophrenia which has puzzled many observers. Jews, religious, even Orthodox in their private life, yet radically secularistic in their public activity. This duality is bound to become more and more difficult to maintain in present-day America, with its very high valuation of religion. Indeed, considerable sections of the newer generation of American Jews are beginning to find the negativism of official attitude both unreasonable and unviable, and are searching for new approaches that will bring them closer to the main body of the other four religious communities in the United States. I'll complete this after the holidays. I want to add one point on this. There has been tremendous change in Jewish opinion produced by the agency, the prayer, the school prayer. For the third time in history, the author, the council, the council, the Federation of Orthodox Rabbis, was unable to take a vote on government federal church schools because the council found itself, the convention found itself completely divided. They therefore did not take a vote, they stayed from voting. The two sides were almost equally matched. Now, 10 years ago, that would have been unthinkable. As a convention of the rabbis, when they take a vote, it was a vote in favor of anti-Semitism. And yet it happened in this brief period. It'll be difficult to do.